This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
You've heard of coerced confessions before. The all-night interrogations, the psychological pressure, the good cop, bad cop routine. All of that. Yeah. Straight out of a crime drama. But what happened to Richard Allen wasn't ripped from TV. It was quieter, was more insidious, and in some ways far more effective. Instead of beating a confession out of him in a cramped interview room, they put him in what Bob Motta calls passive coercion, a extended isolation, no real human contact, and steady erosion of his mental health until he started slipping into psychosis. And in that fog, he started saying what they wanted to hear, not in some coherent courtroom-ready statement, but in rambling, disconnected admissions made between bites of food and feces, and hallucinations about crimes that never took place. The state will call those confessions, the defense will call them what they are, unreliable products of a mind under siege. When you combine that with the fact that he was still a pretrial detainee, legally presumed innocent, the picture gets even darker. So the question becomes, was this about keeping him safe or was this about breaking him down? Let's get into it.
I mean, you're asking a guy who happens to be of the mindset, and I say this, you know, with no hesitation. Yeah. I happen to think that he's wrongfully convicted.
Yeah.
In light of that, and I thought that the PCA leaned not guilty when I first read it, just because of the weakness of the evidence that they presented within it, which was essentially mere presence at the bridge, which came from him volunteering the information to him within 2 days of the crime occurring and the unspent round.
Yeah.
Right. So, and that was it. And then you had a bunch of people that claimed that they saw somebody out on the bridge who the state has always opined was bridge guy, yet not one of those people gave any kind of description that came even close to matching Richard Allen.
Yeah.
So when that thing came out, I'm like, this thing stinks. They have to have more. So when I'm thinking about it in terms of that, and then when I look back after sitting through the trial, and it turns out that that's what they had. They had those two things, and then Their theory that this round that they found in the memory box was some kind of souvenir, that was essentially their evidence against him. Mm-hmm. Like they felt that if we can prove that Bridge Guy committed the crime and that Richard Allen, in our estimation, was there at the time that Bridge Guy was there, which is in dispute, it just is,
yeah.
You know, that we're going to be able to make this case. I think the reality is if you ask any honest prosecutor the question, if these were the facts and evidence that you had at the point in time when you're deciding whether or not to move forward with this case, if you had your druthers, would you want more? Mm-hmm. Any prosecutor that's being honest will say, yes, I want more. When they get his devices after they do the search, and it was a lot of devices that they pulled from his house, you know, it was computers, you know, tablets, multiple phones, 15, 16 phones, and they find nothing that you would expect to see from your typical kind of person that is going to commit this type of crime with this kind of violence against girls, you know, young girls. You typically would see a buildup.
Yeah.
In terms of whether it was some kind of like torture porn, kiddie porn, whatever it is.
You'd see what he's into. Yeah.
Right. Whatever he's like, he's building up to it. Like a 47, 48 year old man, it seems far fetched to me, just decides one day after he leaves his mother's house to go drive out to a bridge and kill two girls.
Yeah.
To me, in terms of what I've experienced in my career in dealing with some pretty bad people, that's not how this typically works.
That he doesn't even know are there. Like he has no idea who these girls, he just show up, just look for the kids, just look for whoever. I mean, just right, randomly, just, I mean.
Total crime of opportunity, you know, like just goes out there. So like the thing just stunk to me. So when you kind of look at it through that lens, and I can't help but look at it through that lens, and I realize that there's people out there that believe he's guilty and that, you know, when it, like they found the round, like that's straight evidence. You know, he said he was there. He's bridge guy. You know, I hear what they're saying. I reject it.
Yeah.
Just based on the fact that I really dug into this case very, very diligently. And that's my opinion. And my opinion is what it is. And I respect other people's opinions. But when you look at it in terms of the relative weakness, in my estimation, of the evidence, it became apparent to me that early on that they were going to need a confession from him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the mindset going in. So that was a really long answer for a very short question on whether or not that was really what their intent was in terms of keeping him safe. No, I think that they thought if they got him in there and put him in the worst, you know, the worst of the worst in terms of prisons in Indiana and the most secure cell within the worst prison in Indiana. And they had the shit that happened to him, which is inmates screaming at him constantly, him being shut off from everything other than an hour a day. You know, them shutting him off from ever being able to have face-to-face contact with the person that he needed it most from, which was Kathy, his wife of 35 years, that they were hoping that this guy would cave and say, hey, you know, we can get you out of here. We'll get you out to Cass County, but just say you did it. Just admit it. Just tell us you did it. And then eventually when he slips into psychosis, he starts saying, I did it. I think I did it. Yeah. They're telling me I did it.
You know, it's like, basically like, so, oh, we'll get a confession out of him. Just send him over here. We'll get it done for you. Something of that nature. Yeah.
Right. I mean, it didn't have to be like torturing him and beating him. It was
I mean, and that's what gets me about the confessions and all of that, because he's psychotic. He's between bites of poop confessing that he did this. You wouldn't be able to have him sign a legal document at that moment in time and deem it valid. Right. Why would a confession to murders be deemed valid right when he's also confessing to murdering his grandchildren that don't exist?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's going to definitely be one of the avenues of the appeal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he was that they weren't voluntary in that sense, and that he wasn't in any way, shape, or form able to formulate clear thought at that point, you know, because like in the pushback you get is that when people are listening to these phone call overhears, you know, that he doesn't sound like a sweaty tooth madman.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like he sounds like he's got almost no affect when he's speaking, but you know, he's making full sentences. And I think that most people who don't understand mental illness and how it operates,
mm-hmm.
I think when people think of psychosis, that they think that that's a constant state that somebody's in and they're always like a raving lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not the case, you know? And I think that the concept of slipping in and out of reality and having an understanding of what's real and what's not real is something that is really difficult for people that have never had personal experience, whether it be themselves or whether it be somebody in their family, a loved one, a friend, whoever, mm-hmm. whoever, you know, where you see it firsthand, just how vivid and real mental illness is, people have a hard time wrapping their mind around it, you know? And it's like, I get the pushback online. They're like, oh, well, he was meeting with Walla once, you know, like every day. I'm like, I don't give a shit. The guy was out of his mind.
Yeah.
Like that's not a relationship wherein he's feeling the kind of security that he needs to feel. Like nothing is going to be able to replace Kathy Allen being able to go visit her husband. Just sitting across behind a plexiglass, you know, window, like would have been everything to mm-hmm. him. To have her be able to get there where he's making eye contact with her and, you know, she's saying, I love you. And, you know, even if he's slipping into it at that point, just having that come, like they knew that cutting him off. I mean, there's no other explanation as to why they cut him off from her.
Yeah.
Like this is a man who is presumed innocent at this point, who's being held in a prison, you know, and like people are like, oh, well, he was being treated better than the other prisoners. I'm like, well, no, he wasn't. And even if he was, he's a pretrial detainee. He still has all his rights under the law.
Yeah.
He's not a convicted felon. That's who's in prison. So you can't compare apples and oranges. He's in a different legal status than a convicted felon would be. So like all those arguments are just, to me, they hurt because it just shows the mindset of an awful lot of people out there that really just don't take into consideration people's mental health in this
world.
Not
at all. No. I mean, and that's such a huge part of this whole
huge
case. And the fact that he didn't, again, not convicted and being treated this way. That's the insane part about all of that. Let me ask you in that area. I know the argument is, well, we moved him here for his own safety, and we ended up seeing what happened. Didn't have access to. Doesn't he legally have the right to be able to have visitors to see his wife, but not being convicted yet?
I mean, I would think so.
Isn't that all part of this? Like, it's just there's so many things that are wrong. Is there any repercussion for the folks who made these decisions? I mean, obviously they think they got their guy on their books. They're done. He's over. He's gone. He's in prison. But if this were to get re-brought up and they were to finally go and say, look at all these crazy things you did to this man and you just got away with it. Is there any repercussions for anybody in this system who allowed this atrocity to take place?
Yeah, I mean, there's you can file a 1983 civil rights action, mm-hmm. and it was a violation not only of his civil rights but his human rights.
Yeah,
you know, so yes, but the problem is there's a statute of limitations on that.
Yeah,
and from all accounts, that has not been filed. There hasn't even been notice of filing that has been filed. So I mean, the issue of whether the statute's going to run on that, but yeah, you sue them. You know, I mean,
why hasn't that been done?
I wish I could give you that answer, man. It's like, I'm behind the scenes in terms of knowing a lot of the people that have worked on the case. And I'm not getting any kind of real answer to that, Tony.
No.
It's befuddling to me. And a lot of people are really upset about it.
What Bob just laid out, he isn't some abstract legal debate. It's a reminder of how thin the line can be between productive custody or protective custody and psychological punishment. Richard Allen wasn't just cut off from the outside world. He was cut off from the one person who could have kept him tethered to reality. His wife. This wasn't an accident. This was a choice, not by Richard, but by the people who were holding him hostage. And here's the part that sticks. There's supposed to be rules for this, rights that even the accused retain. But rules don't mean much if no one enforces them. And rights are meaningless if the people in power decide they don't apply to you. Which leads to the next logical question. When officials make these choices, choices that may have long-term consequences for a man's sanity, his trial, and even the integrity of the case, is there any accountability? Or do they just keep moving, untouched, because the guy's already convicted? Let me know your thoughts in the comment section, wherever you are listening to this. If it's on YouTube, thank you. Please comment there. Search Hidden Killers with Tony Bursky to find us there or wherever you get podcasts. We'd love to hear your voice. And please do press subscribe. Until next time, I'm Tony Bursky. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.